Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with historian David Reynolds. He is distinguished professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And we'll be talking about a period in American history that he argues, if you look at the whole picture of society, politics, and culture, he argues this is maybe one of the richest periods in American life. And we are talking about the years between 1815 and 1848. This was a time when there was a great expansion in both territory and population, coupled with a growing sense of America's power. It is a time when we saw some of the greatest authors here in America, people like Emerson, Thoreau, Poe, Nathaniel Hawthorne. It was a time when there were a number of important inventions, the railroad, telegraph, the mechanical reaper, others. A time of great economic growth here in the United States. And at the center of all of this, the man who, in many ways, was America's first modern president, Andrew Jackson. Our guest is the author of a new book that explores this period of American history. And the title of his book is Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson. Harper is the publisher. So I'm sure that you can go out and find it in the bookstore, as well as his other books. They include John Brown, Abolitionist, Walt Whitman's America. That book won the Bancroft Prize and the Ambassador Book Prize and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Another book, Beneath the American Renaissance. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. At any point, if you have questions, they are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that they're brief. Keep their comments brief so we can keep our program moving along. But, of course, people who are listening, anyone who is listening, is welcome to call. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Reynolds, hello.
Yes, hello. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. And how are you?
Just fine. Thank you.
Good. I appreciate you talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
The thing that strikes me and I think is interesting about this time, and it's something that I only appreciate now having done some reading about this time, is that I think, and you can tell me if this is going too far, I think that's what's interesting about this time is that in many ways it marks the dividing line between early America and modern America. True?
Yes, I think so. I think that's very true. This was the time with the rise of the market economy, the rise of capitalism. It was the time of the first advertising agency, the first department stores. It was when the stock exchange was instituted. It was the early corporations. These weren't huge corporations such as we have today, but kind of the early forms of the corporations. So this was a transitional moment between the bygone subsistence economy by which Americans lived off the land and kind of raised their own vegetables and their own animals, and the future market economy of capitalism in which goods were bought and sold outside the home, and you had the rise of more of a consumer culture.
And I mentioned the fact that this was a time when there was a significant increase in territory and in population. And I think also one of the things that certainly you see at this time is that there's a great urban growth. That is, here we see a significant growth in the population of cities.
Yes, the growth of the cities at that moment far outpaced the growth of the country. Although the country remained primarily agricultural, still the rate of growth of the cities was far higher than that of the country population. And at the same time, we expanded our territory south through Florida and then all the way west to California through acquisition of territory, a lot of it acquired through treaties or through the Mexican War of the 1840s. And it was the period of manifest destiny. That was a phrase that was coined in 1845 in a magazine, and it suddenly spread like wildfire and became the ideology of America. We have this destiny that God has given us to spread democracy elsewhere. At that time, it was into the Western territories. Since then, of course, we've applied it to other nations as well, where we feel that God has designed it so that we should spread our democratic values.
You know, if the numbers of books on this time are any indication, it's something that is now receiving more attention than it has, at least within the last couple of years. There's your book. There have been other books about this time, and also a couple of new biographies of Andrew Jackson.
Right.
Would suggest that that we're now paying attention to this time maybe a little bit more than we had. Is it the case, do you think, that it is something that has been neglected?
Well, I think that, you see, there was a Pulitzer Prize-winning book by Arthur Schlesinger that came out in the 1940s called The Age of Jackson. And since then, there have been other books. And as you mentioned, the last couple of years, there have been a couple of other surveys of the period. And then this year, there's a new biography of Jackson. Where my book really differs from all of those is that I try to include the entire picture of the period. Yes, I have all the elections, the presidents. I have Andrew Jackson at the very heart and center of my book. And I have pictures of society, but I also have extensive pictures of what was going on in the culture, among the writers, the authors, the actors, the musicians, almost as though if one were writing a book about the 1960s, and on the one hand, yes, you would learn a lot if you just talked about JFK, LBJ, and the rise of Nixon and all of that. But I think you would learn much more if you also heard about the entire Cultural Revolution and the clothing fads and the music and all of that. So I try to give a total picture of the period, whereas most previous books have only given a partial picture.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that it is true, and in what way is it true, that we see at this time the emerging of a kind of American identity, that people thought of themselves as Americans, thought of America as a kind of a place that they hadn't before? Is something new emerging?
I believe that here the symbolism of someone like Andrew Jackson comes into play, because at the end of the War of 1812, he wins this glorious victory over the British at the Battle of New Orleans. And that one event, in a way, kicks off this new period of nationalism. The battle hymn of the Star-Spangled Banner, which we still sing at ball games and so forth, was written around the time of that battle, actually shortly before that battle. But anyway, and that kind of signaled a new kind of intense nationalism and a belief in America. And the thing about Jackson is that he was the first president that was born in a log cabin, the first one that that was from the West. It was then the West. It was Tennessee. Mm-hmm. But and the first one that was not part of the Virginia dynasty, like Washington through Monroe, or part of the Federalist New England dynasty, which is the two Adams, John Adams and John Quincy Adams. So he was Andrew Jackson was a new kind of democratic voice. And when he becomes the symbol of America, it's almost like a common person, but also an extraordinary person who is both very average on the one hand and also extremely individual and extremely heroic and courageous on the other. So he becomes, in a sense, America writ large, so to speak, and becomes the new kind of symbolic everyman, American everyman, who's intensely nationalistic. And at the same time, very, very individual.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the big changes, one of the many changes that we see at this time, is a change in the presidential elections and in campaigns.
Yeah.
And previous to this, it was considered, in fact, rather bad form to either say that you wanted to be president, you were seeking the nomination, or that you would campaign for it.
Yes.
And this is a point where we're starting to see the beginnings of modern campaigning. And
yes.
to that extent, do you think that it actually was the case that for people who had voted for Andrew Jackson, that there would have been more people that actually would have had the opportunity to see him or hear him or get some sense of who he was more than secondhand or third hand?
Yes. Andrew Jackson is the first one who, not that he goes out on any long campaigns, because he doesn't, but he does make important appearances before the people. And he becomes a symbol of the new kind of campaigning of making personal appearances. Before that, as you mentioned, it was considered undignified to actually go out on the campaign trail and to make public speeches. In general, through newspapers, you spread your views and your followers might help hold rallies. But Jackson made these symbolic appearances, and people went just absolutely wild over Andrew Jackson. He could have been perhaps our most popular president in all of American history, and one of his opponents grumbled, Jackson could be president for life if he chose to be. He did serve for two terms, and he was just incredibly popular. But at the same time, there was a lot of dirty campaigning that was introduced when he ran for presidency. His opponents falsely charged him with being the son of a prostitute and who was actually a mulatto, and that Jackson himself had a brother who was sold as a slave. This was a complete fabrication. But on the other hand, it was the beginning of kind of dirty campaign politics that on some level even lasts until modern times.
Yeah, that's. I think I probably have said this before in talking about past elections, particularly the one involving Thomas Jefferson, that if people think politics today are negative, it's nothing compared to what has gone on in America's past.
Yeah, and even Jackson was not above fabricating stories about his opponents, because John Quincy Adams, his opponent in 1828, was charged by the Jackson people of having been a pimp in Russia when Adams had served as a diplomat in Russia. Supposedly, he traded the favors of a young secretary, a pretty young secretary, for certain political favors to the Tsar of Russia. Now, this was a fabricated story as well, but there was a lot of mudslinging. And in a sense, even though we still have mudslinging today, we have a certain transparency in the sense that the media can check and double check and, you know, triple check and everything, just to maybe find out a little more of what is the truth. Back then, they didn't have the mass media to kind of pry all of this open. So in a sense, it was even dirtier back then.
You know, as you mentioned, there is some very significant differences between Jackson and all of those men that were president before him.
Yeah.
And that he very much was seen, represented himself as a man of the people. And I'm sure the people will know the story of when he was elected president and he threw open the doors of the White House to the great unwashed, and the people kind of trashed the place. So though in his the way he conducted himself as president, do you see a different kind of a spirit, perhaps a different kind of a sensibility, reflecting his regional base? Do you see a greater sense of populism in those things that he did? Does he really stand apart from those men who had come before?
To me, I think he represents two significant things about America. The poet Walt Whitman, who was very influenced, he came later, but he was influenced by Jackson. He was a Democrat and Jacksonian, and Whitman said, "The great thing about America is that, on the one hand, it is a country that allows you to be very individual and express yourself individually. On the other hand, every individual, in a sense, identifies in a common way with everybody else around him or her in America, or ideally should. In other words, there's this very intensely individualistic impulse that America allows for, and at the same time, a very democratic and all-embracing impulse that America ideally allows for. And to me, Andrew Jackson really represents this combination of the forceful individual, someone who could wage war against the Bank of the United States, someone who passed more vetoes vetoes than all presidents before him, someone who kind of represented the common people. So he was a very strong individual. At the same time, he was so incredibly beloved by the average, everyday working American in a way that no other president before him had been. So he represents that combination of the intense individualism and the intense democracy at the same time.
He certainly has come in for his share of criticism, particularly for his treatment of Native Americans and maybe generally for his attitudes toward people who were not white. And I think that has certainly affected the way that he's been seen by past generations and by past historians. Are we at a point here where we're doing some kind of a reassessment, at least trying to weigh everything as we are thinking about this man and his character?
I think we're reassessing simply by putting him in his own time. Obviously, his treatment of Native Americans was not admirable because he displaced so many of them. They owned all his territory in the East, particularly the Southeast, and he, through treaty and all that, forced them to go west to the Indian Territory and took away their lands that they had previously inhabited in the East. And there was a lot of cruelty and fraud involved in that. The way we try to explain that nowadays, or the way I do, is that he did this, but at the same time, it's really what all the other presidents before him, from Jefferson onward, had wanted to do. They hadn't done it in a sort of organized fashion. They had kind of done it piecemeal. And he's the one who kind of followed through in this. It was a horrible thing. I would hope that today this whole situation with our more progressive view would be handled in a very different fashion. But he lived in an era, Jackson did, that was very sadly extremely racist, that you could count almost on your fingers the white people in America who did not have extreme racial prejudice. You know, maybe a little more than on one's fingers, but I'm saying that there were very, very few. And so he reflected the kind of general backward and primitive, and today we would consider them appalling, racial attitudes of his period that were prevalent. And it doesn't excuse these attitudes, but it puts them in a kind of historical context. He was a slave owner himself. He opposed both the abolitionists who wanted to get rid of slavery, and he opposed the extreme Southern fire eaters who thought slavery was the best thing since sliced bread, and they were very pro-slavery. So he opposed both extremes. He saw himself as a moderate. In retrospect, he does look like a kind of typical 19th century racist. But we have to remember that even Lincoln, the great emancipator, said he declared there are such differences between whites and black people that he thought black people should be shipped out of the country permanently, and they should be shipped either to Liberia or to Central America or South America. They should be shipped abroad. And there were so many people from Jefferson through Lincoln through Harriet Beecher Stowe who believed that blacks, once they were emancipated from slavery, should be shipped out of the country. So, you know, you have to put Jackson in a little bit of historical perspective.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Reynolds. He is Distinguished Professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His most recent book is Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson. It's published by Harper, and it looks at not only the presidency of Andrew Jackson, but also what was happening in the United States in the period between 1815 and 1848. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that we want to make sure to mention here, interesting that was happening in politics or happened in politics, that again sets this this period here where Jackson was running for president the first time, sets it apart from what had gone before. And this is something perhaps not everybody knows, that before that, to vote, you had to be a property owner. And this was the first election when that requirement, now, of course, only white men at the time could vote, but at least it expanded the franchise that much so that that property-owning requirement didn't hold any longer.
Right. By the time that Jackson was running in the 1820s, that whole restriction on the vote, it had been extremely restrictive early on, and then progressively more and more states did open the vote to people other than merely property owners. There were still a couple of holdouts at the time in Rhode Island and in South Carolina. There were still property qualifications, but just the majority of states by that time had broadened the vote to include people even without property. It was restricted, as you mentioned, to white males. Women would not have the vote until 1920, and African Americans gained the vote after the Civil War. But so at this time, it was mainly white males, but they didn't have to hold property, which in general, which was good.
What was the justification for that as a qualification for voting?
The justification for the property owners was that, in general, owning property was associated with civic virtue, with responsibility. It also indicated often a measure of education. But it was really, I think, an aristocratic, kind of old-fashioned, maybe sort of a British, at the time, a British kind of holdover that really didn't fit the democratic spirit of America, which puts all people on the same level. And I think increasingly it was recognized that this was an unfair arrangement whereby only people with certain levels of property could vote.
Hmm. Maybe one of the, when you think of what were the big issues that we wrestled with as a country during the 20th century, certainly America, its place on the world stage, American power, how it should be exercised, those were all important questions. Another of the things, though, I think it's interesting about the time that we're talking about is really that's when this kind of argument and the idea of American exceptionalism that we still talk about, America, does it have some sort of responsibility to exercise power? How should its power be exercised? All of that, really, that as a matter of debate and a conversation really starts at this point that we're talking about.
Well, that's one reason why I call my book Waking Giant, was that for the first time America was really defining itself both economically and on the world scene. President James Monroe in the 1820s defined the Monroe Doctrine, by which America really had superiority in the whole Atlantic region, in the Western Hemisphere, whereas previously European powers were kind of interfering with the affairs of the Americas, and in particular with Latin America, with South America. Countries like Spain and England and many other European countries were getting involved in the affair. And finally, Monroe just put his foot down and says, there's not going to be any more of that, that basically we are the protectors, fundamentally we are the protectors of the Western Hemisphere and the Atlantic region. And then another president, Tyler, made a similar declaration about the Pacific all the way to the Hawaiian Islands, then called the Sandwich Islands. But he established the so-called Tyler Doctrine that defined American supremacy for part of the Pacific region as well. So it's not that we quite become a superpower at this moment, but we lay the ground for becoming a superpower later on and a real player on the world scene.
And is that a result largely of the kind of the other things that we've talked about, growing territorial expansion, growing economic power, just this sense of this growing American sort of muscularity? Is that where this comes from?
Yeah, because our annual economic growth is kicking into a pretty healthy growth during this period. And because we're gaining so much territory, in a sense, America does wake up, it becomes conscious of its potential for being a giant on the world scene. And previous to that, there really hadn't been nearly that much self-confidence. This was a period of self-confidence, of progress, of optimism about America and what it could become. Not that it quite became that, because it wouldn't become that until, let's say, the late 19th and early 20th century. But there was this drive and a belief that someday America would be a great world power. and we were just waking up to that sense of mission and that sense of destiny and the sense of America's place on the world scene. Mm.
And I just wonder, you know, to what extent that helps in this business of maybe in a sense we're going back to something we talked about earlier, but in forging the sense of American identity so that we have a point where previously perhaps people would have thought of themselves more as New Yorkers or Philadelphians or Virginians, yeah, or what have you, or would identify with their region. And I'm sure that people still did that, but that there was a growing sense that there was this identity, that there was a thing that was called being an American that somehow transcended those other kinds of identities.
Yes. What happened is that before this period, for example, there was someone named John Randolph, and he said, "I am loyal to Virginia." And then there were other people that were so loyal to New England. This was during the War of 1812, or very, very early on, when they wanted to separate from the country and form their own nation. But this sense of just being an American grows incredibly during this period. The one thing compromising that tendency toward being American was the difference over slavery. And ultimately, in 1860, 11 southern states did form their own nation based on slavery. And they became the South, the Confederate States of America, and that created the Civil War. But then, but in a sense, this period is kind of leading up to this explosion. We almost needed this explosion of the Civil War then to forge the new nation, the new union, that was based on the ideals of equality, the ideals of integration, and embracing people of all races and backgrounds into the American fabric. And it's really then that after the Civil War in the late 1860s that you get the real American transcended idea of America that begins to arise. Although even today, obviously, there are strains and stresses and certain forms of segregation and so forth that even last with us up to this day. But at least after the Civil War, you begin to get this definition of being an American that really kind of sweeps over the nation. But the entire period that I study kind of leads up to that, and I think foresees that.
Our guest, again, let me introduce, and we have a couple of callers. Our guest is David Reynolds. He teaches at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He is an historian. He's authored a number of books, including John Brown Abolitionist, Walt Whitman's America. That book won the Bancroft Prize and the Ambassador Book Prize and was finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, Beneath the American Renaissance. And his new book is Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson, and it's published by Harper. Questions are welcome. We have a couple of people here ready to go. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Belgium is up first, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning. I have to preface this by saying that I did miss a few minutes of your discussion, and I hope I'm not covering the same ground.
Okay.
But the period that you seem to be writing about is it matches the period of an ethnic cleansing in America. In relationship to Native Americans that existed, especially in the eastern half of the United States. And with what you just said, we're okay with all people except some, especially when it comes to we wanted their land badly.
Right. Well, I mean, the two blights on this whole Jacksonian period, the two main ones, there are many blights, but one of the terrible problems, of course, was the treatment of Native Americans and of African Americans. You had eventually you would have 4 million African Americans who were enslaved in slavery, and then hundreds of thousands and even millions of Native Americans who were forced off of their territory. And both Andrew Jackson and Martin Van Buren were the ones that were chiefly responsible for this. The way I explained it before was that, sadly enough, racism was all but universal in that period, It doesn't excuse it or pardon it, but even Lincoln thought the blacks and whites could never live together, and that blacks must be shipped out of America. This is Abraham Lincoln, should be shipped out of America and sent either to Africa or to Central America. He preferred Central America. So, and that was an ardent anti-slavery guy like Abraham Lincoln. So you have to put Jackson in perspective. He did it in a bad way, I think, because he passed a couple of treaties that were not truly approved, for example, by the Cherokee Indians. He forced this treaty through Congress. He used his henchmen to force the treaty through Congress. And then he sent soldiers down there into the South to kind of force the Cherokees off of their rightful territory. You're absolutely right to oppose this. I do. I think anybody sensible would oppose this. The only way you can put it in perspective is to say that virtually every president from Jefferson onward had this in the back of his mind to do this. So in other words, Jackson was sadly very representative of what all the presidents before him had wanted to do. And Jackson said, okay, we'll give them the state of Oklahoma and we'll just take over their lands in the east.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Effingham next, line one. Hello.
Good program, Dave. Always that. Two questions. Of course, history, you know, from Trojan times forward through the Greeks and the Romans and all the other things in the Middle East and such. Did Jackson and his predecessors sniff the air and understood that hegemony was the future for the U.S.? And the second question would be, did your research expose the claims or, I better rephrase that, the penchant for international spying? You know, such as we have now, which the CIA and some of these other entities are horrendous. And I wonder if that same sort of, I think of Nathan Hale, you know, and his comments. But nevertheless, was that part of the American beginnings toward hegemony? Everyone in history, I think, used spies, but was it organized? Or if it existed.
Right. Hegemony definitely took shape during this period. It took the shape mainly of manifest destiny, which was not a phrase coined by Jackson, but was coined by people just after him during this period. And that was, again, the belief that God had designed so that American democracy would spread throughout the world. And we definitely assumed a world posture of the God-inspired nation who represented democracy, and that we should be actually aggressive in spreading democracy. So absolutely, that's when this whole idea. As far as the CIA and all of that, I mean, this was a relatively primitive period. We did have spies, and we did have diplomats, and then, as you mentioned, detectives or spies and so forth. But it was not at all organized during this period. It was very... It was done on sort of an individual basis. There was no sort of central organization behind any kind of espionage or spying or subversive action or whatever on foreign nations. We tended to try to use money and diplomacy and sometimes military action, but that whole concept of the CIA and so forth was still a thing of the future.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank the caller and go on to Champaign for the next. Line number two. Hello.
Yes, I'll retrace a little bit of what you were just talking about, I think, in my question. But I wonder, I haven't read your book, unfortunately, but I'm curious whether you write about this or have what your view would be on this. We were, of course, very much through 1812, very much in a defensive posture, right, as a former colony and so forth. And we go into a very active and very soon thereafter expansionist period, the, of course, Trail of Tears being, you know, one action within that. But what I'm curious is, There is, of course, as you noted, the ideology of manifest destiny that is clearly related to increased expansionism, or at least it's an ideology that supported expansionism and which built on the Monroe Doctrine and so forth.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, anti-intellectualism or anti-elitism, I personally associate very much with the period you're talking about. That this, the founding fathers were very much sort of figures of the Enlightenment. And from this era on, with Jackson in particular, and those thereafter, and the movement westward, America, the character of America, in many ways changed. There may have been a national identity, but also, very much perhaps connected with that, a kind of anti-elitism that also was sort of related to that expansion. But I'm just curious what your...
Yeah, well, in a sense, you do get the rise of anti-intellectualism. Jackson was not only a symbol of the common people, but a family member said that he had only read one book all the way through other than the Bible, and that was a novel called The Vicar of Wakefield. Apparently, he got through law school without reading a book all the way through. And another family member said that Jackson thought the world was flat. And people always had to edit his speeches to correct his grammar. He did have a native eloquence, a natural eloquence. But, yeah, he was pretty much anti-intellectual, as opposed to John Quincy Adams, his arch foe, political foe, who knew seven languages, who was a scholar in all sorts of topics. Even while he was president, John Quincy Adams was a scholar and everything. So Andrew Jackson, who kind of changes the period and represents the future, is distinctly anti-intellectual. It was, however, a time of great intellectual flowering with people like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Herman Melville, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Edgar Allan Poe. So at the same time, you did have the rise of a viable intellectual culture. Even those great writers, however, were, as I show in my book, Waking Giant, were influenced by Andrew Jackson. So they tried to, even though they were intellectuals themselves, they tried to usher into their own works the kind of democratic common man themes that actually Jackson represented. And someone like Walt Whitman, who in his poem says, "I am Walt Whitman, one of the roughs, one of the street people." He wanted to identify as just one of the average men, sort of the way Andrew Jackson was. And he idolized Andrew Jackson, and one of his brothers was named Andrew Jackson Whitman. Even these great writers, even while they were defining a new intellectual vista for America, tried in some way to integrate the new Jacksonian vision.
Yeah, it seems that our presidents have, since that time, the vast majority have been great inheritors of that sort of Jackson, closer to the sort of anti-intellectualism, anti-elitism, that they've, to speak to the vast middle of the country, the so-called red states, I suppose.
I mean, since Andrew Jackson, it's not good to present yourself as an intellectual per se. You know, you have to espouse to some degree a common man persona to win over the average American, usually as a politician.
Yeah, and I think I'm glad you've studied this and written about this, because I think is something very American. And I study East Asia, and if you look at East Asia, or you look at even India, you know, you'll have leaders, Germany, for example, you have leaders who are extremely intellectual, and Obama is such an incredible exception in our case.
Yeah, he is. He tried to avoid presenting himself as overly like an egghead or something.
Right.
He kind of de-emphasized the whole Harvard thing and all of that, but still, he was very different in some ways. Anyway, I hope you read my book.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
All right, well, thank you. Other questions are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is David Reynolds. He is Distinguished Professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and his most recent book, if you'd like to read it, is titled Waking Giant: America in the Age of Jackson, and that is Andrew Jackson. We're talking talking about there, published by Harper, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm glad we have touched on the something a little bit other than politics, although it connects to politics.
Yes.
Because as you said at the beginning, one of the things that you were trying to do with the book was give a picture, a broader picture of American life at the time. Obviously, you do and must spend a lot of time talking about Andrew Jackson, since he was the guy that was really kind of sort of the centerpiece and struck the tone.
Yes.
But you were talking about writers. Also in the book, you mentioned the fact that also this is a time when we have some of the most significant American painters that come along. We have the writers that you mention. Would it be correct to say that this was the beginning of or at least a point where previously writers would have somehow identified with Europe or would have identified with Britain or would have had one foot still in that world, and that what we start to see here is that there are writers that really do identify with their own place?
Oh, absolutely, because at the beginning of the period, there was a Scotland critic from Scotland who dismissively said, oh, who in the four corners of this earth reads an American book? Who reads an American book? By 1850, 30 years later, you had Edgar Allan Poe, who was very well known abroad, Emerson, who was extremely well known. You had James Fenimore Cooper, Washington Irving, all of them dating from this period. You had Nathaniel Hawthorne with The Scarlet Letter. A little bit later than that, you had Walt Whitman, who was appreciated abroad. You had Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was translated into dozens of languages. A very intense sense of literary nationalism and Americanism arises during this period. And the American writers are very conscious of that. They're conscious. They partake of this new national identity of being an American, absolutely. And indeed, they become well-known throughout the world.
Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I recall from reading Schlesinger's Age of Jackson that 1830 marked the beginning of the first wave of British immigration after the Revolutionary War, and that some of these skilled workmen brought over the craft guild system with them. I wonder if you could comment on whether that had any significance, really, for the American system, and also could you comment on the tariff of 1831 and its ramifications for the economy?
The economic downturn of 1831 or the?
No, actually there was a tariff law passed.
The tariff, right.
Yeah, it took effect in 1832.
Right, it was 1832. The immigration... immigration during this period increased, I won't say exponentially, but beginning around 1830, you mentioned from the British Isles, and then in the late 1830s from Germany and from various other places. Immigration created a whole new mix in America. It did bring new kinds of work and new crafts and so forth. I think it fed directly into the burst of inventions. We had so many important inventions during this period. I think that it was a stimulating factor. It was also a disruptive factor because it created a kind of a backlash on the part of people that were already living here. So there was a lot of anti-immigrant feeling at that time, and as you probably know. But ultimately, I'm positive that this was a good thing. Not a bad thing, despite the kind of disruptiveness on the part of some groups. And I think as far as the tariff of 1832 goes, that was kind of a compromise that was meant to replace the so-called tariff of abominations that had been passed in 1828. And so the new tariff was designed to be a fairly high tariff, but at the same time to decline over the next decade, so its tariff rates would go down a little bit. There was mixed feelings, particularly on the part of Southerners, about tariffs, and the tariffs were seen as protecting New England factories at the expense of southern cotton growers and so forth. So there was a little controversy about that, and so I think the tariff of 1832 was basically a good idea, because it did have a built-in kind of compromise thing whereby the tariff rates would be reduced over the course of a decade. I think ultimately it was good for the economy. It's true that we did go through a recession in 1837 to 1842, but then we had a nice bounce back in the 1840s, and we were kind of on our way to real economic growth after that. So I think ultimately that was also good.
Well, thanks.
Sure.
Could you give us any information on the movement for a 10-hour working day in the East Coast cities that time? Or maybe that was a little early. I don't know.
Well, there was a very strong movement among the working men's parties and parts of the Democratic Party to reduce the working days, which average anywhere between 12 and 14 hours, to 10 hours. And ultimately, under Martin Van Buren, Van Buren comes along in the late 1830s, and he basically says that all federal workers, people who worked with or for the government, should have only 10-hour days. So that was a big deal. And it took a little longer until the late 1840s for the labor union demands for the 10-hour day really to start to kick in on any meaningful level. But it was a demand that had been made as early as the early 1820s, and then it became a rising cry among workers that took quite some time to really get full-scale implementation.
All right. Well, thank the caller. Let's go to somebody else, Champaign County. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, just a short note on your discussion earlier about the removal of the property qualification for voting.
Yeah.
As it was done state by state, you pointed out Rhode Island was an outlier and didn't do it until quite late. But
the door war, yeah.
But I'm just doing a cursory search. I find that there was something called the pauper laws, which sort of, and the suggestion is that they exchanged property for tax paying. So you were still, there was still sort of a judgment that if you weren't in some way wealthy, if not landed, at least having some, that qualification was sort of exchanged in some way, which I'd never known this part of history. I'd forgotten that it was a state by state thing that the property.
Oh, it was very, very much state by state, and yeah, I didn't really have time at that time to kind of get into the technicalities of it, but yeah, several states did have this kind of pauper thing that if you had no recorded income, then you couldn't vote. So there was often this kind of stipulation. It wasn't really a totally universal kind of suffrage. Not only that, but of course we know that women couldn't vote, and people of certain ethnicities couldn't vote, and so forth. So there was. I don't want to pretend for a moment that it was universal suffrage, universal vote. It was not. There was these still some economic laws in place. But thanks for the reminder. Yeah.
Right, it was sort of a societal sort of disqualification. People knew if they weren't really part of the polity in some ways if they didn't have some kind of wealth or something. So there's just that's a legacy, and maybe that's why we have. Maybe that's a supposition on my part that's why we still have very low voter participation from. Compared to other industrialized states. So,
yeah.
Anyway, thanks.
Right. Sure.
We are coming down to the point. We have a minute or two left. There are a lot of interesting things we have not touched on, a lot of things going on in the country at the time. Maybe just one thing you can talk about for a little bit is we talked a little bit about popular culture, talked a little bit about politics and a little bit about technology. This was also a time where there was really an explosion of religious activity and religious fervor around the country.
Yes. What happened is once there was the separation of church and state after the American Revolution, you had a real explosion of different forms of religion. It was a time when many different new religions were created, Seventh-day Adventism and so forth, and there was the Millerite religion, which was sort of an apocalyptic end of the world. You had a lot of cults and sects, a lot of people who proclaimed themselves to be part of God and to be gods themselves, and they became often the kind of David Koresh's or the Jim Joneses of their era, and they became very charismatic. It was the time when the Mormon religion was founded, when Joseph Smith saw angels that gave him these golden plates that he translated into the Book of Mormon, and so on and so forth. It was just an incredible proliferation of different forms of Protestant Christianity. And you also saw the growth of mainstream churches like the Methodists and the Baptists, largely through these very emotional revivals that, in retrospect, almost looked like the Woodstocks of their era, because people went absolutely wild at these revivals, and they just went totally crazy. They felt they were getting directly in touch with God. So it was a very emotional kind of religion.
Yeah. Well, just to finish up, I realize that we're coming. I'm bringing us back to this point of identity again, but I guess that one of the things that really interests me is how it is that national identities, to the extent that they exist, how it is that they are formed, and what it is that contributes to it, and particularly what contributes to this sense of American identity that gets so much energized at this time.
I think that you get a true national identity growing during this period, but it was still confused because of the whole slavery debate, so that the crystallization of what America is comes with Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War, and with that great bloodletting of the Civil War and with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, who becomes kind of a martyr for America, and he becomes the kind of great symbol of the American Union, the idea of a union, the American Union, not just the North, not just the South. So in a sense, it kind of, all this nationalistic energy that we felt after the War of 1812 reaches a kind of culmination in the Civil War and its aftermath. Unfortunately, even after that, we've had periods of Jim Crow and segregation and so forth that has proved to be rather divisive. And so I suppose in a sense you can say that we're still, even to this very day, trying to approach that sense of nationhood that perhaps we haven't totally reached. But I think it's all one long process that really begins after the War of 1812. In a sense, it begins with the Founding Fathers. They define it, but in a kind of jingoistic American sense, it begins after the War of 1812 and then really builds and crystallizes in Abe Lincoln and Civil War.
Our guest, David Reynolds. The book is Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson, published by Harper. David Reynolds teaches at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Professor Reynolds, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.